from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. At least 29 people have died and more than 200 are still missing from the campfire in Butte County, making it the most destructive wildfire in the state's history and one of the deadliest. In Southern California, the Woolsey Fire has destroyed at least 370 structures and killed two people. Here's California Governor Jerry Brown, who is calling on President Trump to make more resources available.
This is not the new normal. This is the new abnormal. And this new abnormal will continue, certainly in the next 10 to 15 to 20 years.
Coming up on Forum, we'll get the latest on the wildfires, including the impact on air quality here in the Bay Area. That's all next, after this. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Devastating wildfires continue to burn on both ends of the state. Yesterday, search and rescue teams found six more bodies in Butte County, bringing the death toll of the campfire to 29, matching the deadliest wildfire recorded in California history. The town of Paradise basically burned to the ground in that fire, which is 25% contained. In Southern California, the Woolsey Fire is 20% contained. Two people have died in that blaze, which has burned nearly 100,000 acres. Firefighters face challenging conditions today: high winds, low humidity, and brush dried out from lack of rain. And although officials stress that the cause of either fire is not yet known, Pacific Gas and Electric and Southern California Edison told state regulators that there were issues with infrastructure where the fire started. And in this hour, we'll get the latest on the deadly fires. Later in the hour, we'll talk with an expert about the air quality, which has forced many Bay Area residents indoors. Joining us first is KQED reporter Sonia Hudson, who is in Oroville, California. Sonia, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. And in the wake of all this devastation and this monumental and horrific fire, I need to get an update from you. And I think the best place to begin is finding out from you what the latest containment figures are and what is CAL FIRE saying in terms of progress.
Yeah, so it's 25% contained right now. It's burned 113,000 acres, and that's up from 111,000 acres at the update last night. So it only grew by 2,000 acres overnight, which might seem like a lot, but keep in mind that when this fire started on Thursday, it grew to 20,000 acres in just over 12 hours, the first 12 hours. So 2,000 acres is actually a pretty good growth rate. So it's still 25% contained. That's no change from yesterday. Firefighters have held containment lines on the edge of Chico really well and are working in some pretty difficult terrain in the hills outside the city, trying to build continuous containment lines there. The winds are, it's still really gusty. There's a red flag warning in place here until 11 a.m. And even after that goes away, it's still going to be pretty windy, not as windy. And one of the big issues also is just how dry the air is. We're getting in single digit fuel moisture contents and single digit humidities here.
We're talking about the campfire with Sonia Hudson, KQED News reporter. We'll be talking with John Sepulveda about fire down in the southern part of the state. How are people coping who have evacuated, and any individual stories you can tell us about?
Yeah, people right now are really just trying to push through, and that means different things for different people. Some people I talked to broke down and cried in front of me. Others were really stoic, even in the face of this tragedy. I met a woman named Katie McCrary, who lives in Paradise. And when I met her, she was sitting on the side of a road with her dog, Harley, by a roadblock at the entrance to an evacuation zone near Paradise. So I walked up and I asked her what she was doing there, since it was clear authorities weren't letting people through. And she told me she was hoping her son, who's among at least 228 people that are still missing, she was hoping that he might come out of the evacuation zone so she could know that he was okay.
There are an astonishing number of people who simply are unaccounted for, aren't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And Katie basically said that, you know, she's sure that her son's okay and kind of refused to accept that he's not. And here's what she had to say about that.
But my son is a pretty ingenuous. He's a camper and a hunter, and so he knows how to take care of himself. So I'm sure his family's all with him, and they've probably gone out in the woods and found a stream and are having a good time.
But a couple of minutes later, you know, that stoicism faded away a little bit, and she did tell me that she was worried.
We're talking again with Sonia Hudson, KQED News reporter, who is with us from Oroville, and we have links on how to help campfire victims on our website, kqed.org/forum. How's this hitting low-income communities, Katie? Sonia, excuse me.
That's okay. Obviously, all wildfires hit low-income communities the hardest. There was actually a study that came out a couple weeks ago from the University of Washington and the Nature Conservancy, and it basically found, you know, low-income people and people of color are disproportionately affected by wildfires. And one of the big differences is the ability to make up the difference between what it costs to rebuild and what you get from your insurance money-wise. Katie McCrary, she lives in an old mobile home in Paradise, and if it burns down, she doesn't think she'll get nearly enough money for it, and she won't be able to afford a new one. So if her house does burn down, you know, she thinks she'll be living out of her car for the foreseeable future, like she's doing now, and essentially she'll be homeless. Another big factor is just the ability to find jobs. This study also found that economic recovery, not only in terms of rebuilding, but just getting your life back together after these fires, is particularly hard for low-income people.
And do we know anything at this point about the cause? There's been certainly speculation about PG&E and their role once again. What do we know?
Yeah, absolutely. It seems like anytime there's a big fire like this, PG&E, people bring up PG&E. We haven't heard anything from CAL FIRE yet about the cause of the fire. It is still under investigation. But my colleague Ted Goldberg has done some really great reporting over the last couple days that may potentially shed some light on what might have happened. Ted found out about an incident at a major PG&E electrical transmission line and while it has not been directly linked to the fire, an outage there did occur in the same spot and just minutes before the campfire is reported to have started. So basically, PG&E informed state regulators that there was this outage, and then about 15 minutes later, the blaze is reported to have started.
And what do we at this point know about shelters, particularly for those who are evacuated? And there are animal shelters also. Can we talk about both?
Yeah, absolutely. There are multiple animal shelters and multiple large evacuation centers. They've kind of been filling up, but we haven't had an evacuation order for the last day or so. So there aren't really any new evacuees coming in. Animal rescue is something that is weighing very heavily on the minds of people here. A lot of the people, when I was at that roadblock at the entrance to the evacuation center, a lot of people were there because they wanted to see if someone could go in and get their pets. I had, because reporters are allowed to go into evacuation zones with their press passes, I had lots of people come up to me and ask me to go get their pets for them. They're really worried about it. And I did try to go into one area where a woman said her house was, but there was a power line in front of the road, so I couldn't access it.
In fact, Paradise has just one way in and one way out, this now incinerated city, which has been, you know, a great deal of the problem as we continue to sort through. And I wanted to ask you also, while I have you on the line, Sonia, about air and water quality. I know that that the Water Resources Coastal Board actually advised Butte County residents to boil water, the control board, excuse me. But now the air quality, I mean, it's unhealthy here in the Bay Area. It must be terrible up there.
Yeah, it's really, really awful. It's especially if you go into the burn areas, like the smoke was so thick, I had to slow down my car several times because I just couldn't see far enough in front of me. It kind of felt like driving through really, really thick fog in the Bay Area. It's definitely, the air is very thick with smoke. We get that, you know, similar to what we've seen in the Bay Area, that kind of red sun a lot of the day. And there's no blue sky. It's all hazy, and it's difficult for people to breathe up here.
Sonia, thank you for being with us, and thank you for the work you're doing up there. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Sonia Hudson. She's a reporter with KQED News. We're now going to go to John Sepulveda, who is host of California Report and who has been covering the Woolsey fire. He's joining us from Santa Monica. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Michael.
Update us. What do we know at this point? What are the prospects?
Well, there's been a lot of good news here in Southern California with the Woolsey fire. First of all, we are seeing 20% containment. That 20% is where it's contained. That line is being built along the most heavily populated areas. I talked to a firefighter this morning. He said, it was a very anecdotal conversation, but he said he felt very optimistic after last night. The winds have died down. That apocalyptic red sun that has become, unfortunately, one of the preeminent pictures of California in the fall is not something that we're seeing right now because the smoke has really drifted out over the ocean. So air quality is good, and there seems to be major efforts. Also, the wind has died down. That's good, too. What's bad is that we've had a doubling of the structures burned. We're up at 370 structures. And unlike what Sonia was telling us, where we're seeing extreme poverty in Paradise, we're seeing the exact opposite of that here, and it's a good reminder that fire is an indiscriminate killer and destroyer. Fire has hurt about 370 structures, burned them to the ground here, and we know that some of those are of some of the most richest people in the history of the world. Miley Cyrus, actor Gerard Butler, musician Neil Young, all of them lost homes here. The other thing that we're seeing is that there's two people who are dead, but unlike in Paradise, we're not seeing the same number of missing folks being reported. So that's a really good sign that many people heeded evacuation or warnings. That doesn't mean that there aren't people who aren't missing, but it's nowhere near the number that it is up north.
And as long as you're making comparisons, you know, there's been some finger pointing at PG&E up north, particularly in light of the fact that they were thinking actually of shutting down the electricity and went ahead and kept it on. But what about Edison down there in Southern California? I mean, there was a high voltage power line near where the fire started, wasn't there?
Yeah, it was very close. As you know, we just heard Sonia praise Ted Goldberg. Let me do the same. Ted Goldberg found a document that was filed by Southern California Edison, and it essentially says that there was a relaying. And what this is when there are electronic sensors at major junction points within electronic transmitters. So in this particular case, it was coming off a substation, the Santa Susana substation, which I know you've talked about this before on forum, an old nuclear site. And from this area, something happened that forced a Southern California Edison relay to shut the power off. Now, it could be that there was something in the lines, and the lines potentially, and I want to make this very, very clear, Michael, to the listeners, potentially could have caused the fire. It could have been that the fire itself set off the sensor, but the relay happened at 2:22 p.m. The fire was reported at 2:24 p.m. So it would suggest that this happened 2 minutes before the fire was first reported. But it's going to be a long time before we know. To give you an idea, Ventura County officials, which are the agency responsible for investigating this fire, the Woolsey fire, they're also responsible for investigating the Thomas fire. And it's been more than a year since they've started that. It's been almost a year since they've started that investigation, and they're still not close to releasing it. So it might be quite some time before we have a definitive answer. But we do know in the past that Southern California Edison has had equipment that started it. In fact, the company came forward and said, look, we had equipment that was responsible for at least one of the ignition points for the Thomas fire. So it is quite possible, again, not proven, but possible that this equipment could have led to this fire.
We're talking with John Sepulveda, host of the California Report. And John, as I'm sure you're well aware, President Trump sent out a tweet, and he was saying that he was threatening actually to hold funds back to aid victims because of blame that he put on institutions here that were supposed to be overseeing forest management and the like. But the reality is down there, it's all chaparral. I mean, you really don't have much in the way of forest, especially in areas like Malibu and Thousand Oaks.
Yeah, I mean, I had a really hard time understanding it. In fact, I tweeted something out about that. I didn't see any trees or forest for there to be managed. That being said, there are some federally controlled wildlife preserves, and there are some limited areas of forest in Malibu. But this did not start in a forest. There's no indication that this started because of forest management policy. And in fact, we know that the deadliest wildfires in U.S. history didn't start because of bad forest management. And I'm talking about the North Bay fires and They started because of, well, they started for other reasons. So my point with it is that I don't really know how to respond to that tweet. It doesn't seem to be grounded in reality.
Well, there was really not a problem with Forests Up in Butte either, so that I don't know how to deal with that tweet either, except it seems to obviate climate change, which maybe, as Governor Brown has pointed out, maybe the major factor after all in this.
Well, yeah, I mean, any scientist you'll talk to, and our KQED science team will be the first one. I can see our science editor, Daniel Venton, like, going to text me right now to be careful with what I say, because you can't directly, according to every expert I've spoken to, you can't directly link climate change to any particular event. That being said, I mean, I've grown up in Southern California. I've seen the hills on fire here before. And like I was telling my colleagues, like, I've never seen anything like this, both with the Thomas Fire and this fire. I mean, we're talking about fire tornadoes, the intensity of these fires, how quickly they burn. And let's keep in mind that there's an argument to be made about sprawl and the rest of it. But these houses that are constructed, a lot of these new construction houses that we saw go up, these are houses that were made to withstand certain fire requirements. So that is a real head scratcher. I agree with you. And as far as like there, it's clearly that there's something going on. What it can be linked to is not for me to say. And I honestly don't know. I will say this, though, too, that here in Santa Monica and on the west side of Los Angeles, you know, this is home to a lot of the activists and the kind of the intelligentsia of the environmental movement. And my phone has been blowing up this morning with folks from the Sierra Club, with folks from the conservation networks who want the media talking about climate change when they talk about this fire. But again, that's out of my pay grade, and I would really defer to our science team to talk about it. But it's clear that something is happening that hasn't happened before.
But what about, all these dead trees and cutting them down and clearing brush? That's just even more fuel for fires.
As far as fire management goes, that is my understanding. I also know, though, that when I lived in Oregon, that sometimes that was helpful. So again, I'm not sure about that particular instance, Michael. But I think what's really interesting is that at least in the Southern California fires that we're talking about, I mean, these aren't forested areas that are being evacuated. These are heavily urbanized. Granted, they're suburban communities, but these are urbanized areas where there's massive sprawl. And there is, I mean, getting out of Malibu, this is one of the things that we were talking about with Sonia Hudson, who you just had on. Getting out of Malibu was incredibly dangerous, not because there was like a fire breathing down people's necks, but because there was one road out, and that was the Pacific Coast Highway, and you had this huge community that's 21 miles long trying to leave on one road to get out, and that caused all kinds of problems. So whether it's the management, whether it's climate change, whatever, the nuts and bolts of it, and that's not to dismiss it, but the nuts and bolts of how we evacuate, how we decide which houses we're going to save and which ones we're not, the policy for that. You know, my colleague at KCRW this morning, Jenny Hamill, we were talking about the fire budget. We've almost exhausted California state fire budget, and we're not even through the year. So this idea that we are going to be having to deal with this is very clear. Let's keep in mind, the Thomas Fire was the largest natural wildfire in California state history. That was soon replaced by the Mendocino Complex. And now we're seeing that these devastating fires that are happening in Southern California and up in where Sonia's at in Paradise are also causing just as much trouble. I mean, this has become a way of life. And it's very, very clear, whether it's dead tree removal or transportation or anything else, we are not equipped right now in our policy apparatus to deal with it.
John, good to have you on. And again, thank you so much for being with us and for the good work you're doing down there. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
John Sepulveda, host of the California Report. I want to bring on Scott Stevens, who is professor of fire science at the College of Natural Resources at UC Berkeley. And professor, good to have you with us. Thank you.
Happy to be here.
I guess this both of these fires point out to what extent really, going off of what we just heard from John, how vulnerable we are and how we really need to be better prepared. And yet there's so much vegetation and there's so many obstacles here that a lot of people are just feeling, you know, extreme tension in the wake of all this.
Well, I agree. You know, if you look at just the way California is, you know, it's a state, we all know, Mediterranean climate, dry in the summer, variability more, I think, with climate change. But when you look at our exposure from a fire perspective in the state, it really is unprecedented. I don't know if there's any other place in the world that has so much exposure in terms of potential problems. And it is difficult. We have that today, and now we need to go forward, you know. And there are places where we can do work to really reduce vulnerability, communities in forest areas. We can do some things to really reduce flame length intensity. But the areas in Southern California you've been talking about is really difficult because, as you said, this is not a forested region. And in here, you can't thin that place. You can't do some things that really could reduce behavior. So I think actually it's more difficult in the chaparral areas of Southern California. At least there's certainly less options to reduce fire behavior.
Well, we should mention that there are billions that have been essentially earmarked to go to vegetation management. That's all good, although Gavin Newsom, the new governor, will have to sign it. It wasn't signed yet by Governor Brown. But this is all happening, and it strikes me, Scott Stevens, repeatedly in November. I mean, how can we factor in climate change or not factor in climate change when we now have no fire season? It's all year round.
Yeah, Southern California's had a year-round fire season, really for several, maybe a decade or two, and it's certainly up and down. Sometimes you get some rain down there earlier. It is migrating north, there's no doubt. We're seeing fire now in Northern California at times of years when we just haven't had it in my career. You know, I grew up in Northern California, lived here my whole life, and we are seeing fires in December, you know, November. And I think climate change tells us for sure that we should expect more variation in our weather patterns, and the patterns of the past aren't going to be the great surrogates for the future. So I think this comes into that notion that we're just seeing, you know, delayed rainfall here, warm temperatures, and I think it is connected to climate change.
And what about just the sense of so much negligence and, well, perhaps arson and carelessness being really the culpable source of so many of these fires?
Yeah, that's a tough one, you know, because here we are with almost 40 million people in the state, and the vast majority of fires are started by accidents of some sort, people making just small decisions that don't do well, parking a car somewhere, sometimes throwing something out the window. Of course, that's foolish. But with so many people in this state, that's an area of ignition that's not going away. I call people fire magnets, and this is just because generally you have people associated with fire because of just accidents. And, of course, arson is the worst ignition of all, because deadly and can be done for terrible purposes, but I'm afraid ignitions from people in this state are going to continue. If anything, they're probably going to increase. We can do better with public education, but look at Smokey Bear. Smokey Bear has been thought of as maybe the third most successful public education campaign in the history of the United States of America. So we've done a good job with that. So it's tough when you have so many people loving wildlands, liking to be outside. I'm afraid those human ignitions and accidents are going to keep coming.
We also need more restoration work in the forests, don't we?
We do. We do. You look at Southern California forests, also the forests of, 1999 to 2002, Southern California had a huge drought. There were congressional inquiries about it that actually killed maybe 40 million trees. And it was really a density problem of trees too dense per acre, number of trees per acre. You get a drought cycle of 4 years, and then you have native insects, the bark beetles, come in and kill. Exact thing happened in Southern California that went up into the Southern Sierra in the last few years. I look at both of those things as symptoms of a bigger problem of forest sustainability having problems.
Scott Stevens with us, professor of fire science at the College of Natural Resources at UC Berkeley, and we are going to be talking soon with Senator Jerry Hill, who wants to maybe do something about the utility, and talking with you as well. And we indeed invite you to join us now if you have some thoughts, if you have something you want to add to the conversation or questions. 866-733-6786 is the number to join us at. Again, that's 866-733-6786, toll free, or email us forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We are continuing our coverage and discussing the fires that are burning across the state of California. Scott Stevens is with us, professor of fire science at the College of Natural Resources, UC Berkeley. We spoke earlier with John Sepulveda of the California Report and Sonia Hudson of KQED News. And I want to bring on Jerry Hill now. Jerry Hill is California State Senator, and he represents the 13th District, which includes San Bruno. We invited PG&E. They declined. And Senator Hill, good to have you back with us. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael. A pleasure to be with you.
I've got to ask you about PG&E and their role in all this, because you talked to KQED News and they reported that you were looking into, in fact, I know you're on the committee that really oversees this, and you're talking about breaking up the utility. What would that do about really helping us with these fires?
Well, I think the one thing it will do is at least change the conversation. PG&E and some of the utilities, and mainly PG&E, though, has had a history of not following the rules, regulations, and some of the laws that have been in place. And I think they put the population and ratepayers and constituents at risk. They have done that because it almost consistently since San Bruno, what we found after that terrible tragedy is they neglected to take the appropriate steps to properly maintain their lines, properly test them. And they diverted $500 million from that was supposed to go to safety and operations. They diverted that money to bonuses and incentives for executives. And it was clearly found out they are on probation today. They were found guilty, as you recall, of 6 felonies in federal court. So they have not acted responsibly. And what we found is they didn't learn from other things. San Diego Gas and Electric, a number of years ago, had a terrible fire in San Diego. They changed their entire operation in their electric system and have what I think is probably the state-of-the-art best practices. PG&E learned nothing from that, and that's when we saw the fires last year. And as you also know, 16 fires were caused that have been investigated so far last year, but caused by PG&E lines, but 11 of those 16 were caused by negligent behavior, at least in part at this point, by Cal Fire, and they've turned that information over to the local district attorney. So we've not seen behavior that I think warrants the trust that we have to place in our utilities. And I think it's time to at least have the conversation about changing that.
But is it also not true that at this point, particularly with the Camp Fire and the Woolsey Fire, we don't know if PG&E, or for that matter, Southern California Edison, were really responsible? We don't know the cause yet, as we found out from talking to our reporters.
Absolutely, we don't know the cause. But we do know, at least from the evidence, at least at this point, shows that the fire started from a broken or a downed wire or right beneath a high transmission line, a 12,000-volt transmission line. And after PG&E noticed a break in that line, the fire started 15 minutes later. Now, what caused that break, we don't know. And as they flew over in the afternoon on Thursday, they found that there was some damage to that pole. So we certainly don't know what the cause is, but we do know that PG&E could have acted, I think, more responsibly by de-energizing their system. They talked about it before, the day before. They said, we may have to de-energize. And as you know, this is something they did not do last year in 2017 with the Tubbs Fire and the others. This is something that San Diego Gas and Electric has been doing for many years now after they learned from their experience in the tragedy of 2007. But PG&E chose not to take that action. They did it a month ago. Why didn't they do it last week in this area? Why didn't they take that precaution that they knew could be the responsible thing to do?
Senator Hill, good to have you on. Thank you for joining us this morning on Forum.
Thank you, Michael. My pleasure. Thank you, Michael.
Jerry Hill, California State Senator who represents the 13th District. And let me go back to you, Scott Stevens. We should mention that PG&E and Southern California Edison have, this is one thing we know at this point, told state regulators that there were issues with infrastructure where the fire started. What about the role of the utility, Scott Stevens?
Well, this is a tough one. You know, I thought about this a lot, like you and a lot of your listeners. What do we do with so many utility poles, so many transmission lines? I agree with the senator that Southern Cal Edison has done a good job of upgrading their infrastructure so they can actually be a little more selective in the areas they want to take the power out. So you can take a small area, be a little more selective in terms of trying to get some of these systems down when you anticipate bad weather. PG&E has a very core system right now and needs to be upgraded. That way you could maybe say, okay, we're going to take out the power of the Feather River Canyon or some parts of Butte County, and we're going to do that a little more selectively versus very, very coarsely. And if you don't think about ways of trying to figure out power lines, it's either de-energizing power lines or doing something and actually removing them from the air and putting them into the ground or on the surface of the ground. I don't know what else you can do. You're basically going to have to de-energize lines or do something with the infrastructure so it's less vulnerable to start fires.
And we are going to continue this discussion and do invite you to join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. If you have thoughts about the fires either north or south or that are raging throughout the state, and have raged, I should say, throughout the state. Scott Stevens with us. He's professor of fire science at the College of Natural Resources at UC Berkeley. And before I go to calls and emails, let me just ask you, Scott, to respond to something that a resident up in Paradise named David Coffey told our reporters.
I wouldn't say I'm surprised. We live in a tinderbox. We saw it happen in the last couple of years and just knew it was going to be our turn one of these days. Here it is.
Your thoughts, Professor Stevens?
Yeah, that's very reflective. You know, it's somewhat true. You know, let's look at the places we built. Paradise, as you said earlier, it's got one road in, one road out. It's a beautiful area. I've been there a few times, but man, does it have vegetation around it too. So it is one of those conundrums that we need to do so much better with the way we actually live and build in the fire environment. It doesn't mean that we have to, you know, just go crazy, but, you know, we can do a lot more in anticipation of a place that actually could be vulnerable. And that's something that we need to work on the next 5, 10, 20 years forever.
And we are going to be talking with the Director of Communications and Outreach for the Bay Area Quality Management District and find out about the air we're breathing. Let's, in the meantime, go to your calls, and let's go first to you, Phil. Good morning. You're on.
Good morning. We had pitched to the National Fire Group, which is in Idaho. And one thing that struck me is, so the speed at which a fire spreads is, it's called the square of the time from detection. Because as the fire grows, it tends to grow in a circle, right? And that as time goes on, it doubles and doubles and it doubles. And one thing that's interesting, it seems that these fires aren't hit really hard, really fast before they get bigger. And that the tactics in the field seem to be, you know, 10 and 20 years older. When are we going to organize different mechanisms for responding to these fires?
Yeah, thank you for that question, Phil. Let me go back to you, Scott Stevens.
Well, it's a good question, and it's a hard one. I know, you know, that fire started in the Feather River Canyon someplace. They had people on it quickly. They saw that fire already going up a very steep ridge. It cut off really the only road that was accessible to the site. So, yes, we could do a little better with the way we actually think about fires and the way we actually fight fires. But I have to say that we're one of the best firefighting regions in the world. So we have great people, highly trained, you know, also trying to do as best they can. But when you got a 40-mile-an-hour wind, you got fuel conditions that's conducive to fire spread, and every year we put out around 98% of all fires less than 5 acres in size. That's just what the data tells us. So I'm afraid we're not going to probably do a lot better there. We can do a little better, but think of the system we have in place today. It's one of the best in the world. So when we have these conditions, I think that even when you try to get on them quickly, fires get big.
Let me thank Phil for his call and go to a question from a listener named Sarur. We're back to power lines here, Scott Stevens. Sarur says, can these high voltage lines be buried in the ground, or can we somehow limit their damage in case of malfunction so they don't start fires? There's always talk about undergrounding. Maybe we should go into this a little more depth from your perspective.
Yeah, there's no doubt undergrounding would take this away because you would just have, you know, the source potential ignition away. I have some friends that live in England, in the British, you know, Isle there, and they underground all their lines. There's no doubt this would be expensive, but you look at the cost of these fires and maybe looking forward in terms of trying to do something that would be proactive. I think something like that is something that has to be considered, and also maybe this idea of strategically taking down power lines. But yes, doing something with our infrastructure of power lines in this state is something that probably should be considered because it's causing a great deal of fires.
What are the cost estimates as far as you can see?
Yeah, I've seen some of those numbers, and they're huge. Yeah. I mean, you'd have to do this over, you know, many, many, many years, probably decades, because of just the number of lines we have. But again, when you compare that to the losses and the loss of life, the loss of homes, the loss of really people's just total life experience, that something that is that severe has to be considered forward. Otherwise, how are we going to do any better? I mean, we have the same infrastructure. We can turn it off better like Southern Cal Edison does, and we can do a little better with PG&E, and that's probably going to be a bigger piece of that. But we just think about the infrastructure, and we have to do something to reduce vulnerability in these high wind events.
Should have been turned off in Butte, shouldn't it?
It could have been, yes. I mean, I don't want to second guess anybody, but there's no doubt when you look at the, you know, the outcome of it, yes, it could have been turned off. And of course, when people have their power off, you have people that are also on devices for home, you know, health care and things of that nature is really insignificant. So it's not a simple decision either, but I think we're going to have to live with more power outages under bad wind.
Here's Shelley joining us. Good morning, Shelley.
Hi, I'm calling. I don't know if you guys have talked about this or not. I just turned on, but so I live in San Francisco. I've been here for 25 years, but I grew up in Modoc County, which is one of the most rural northeastern counties of California. I come from 6 generations of Californians and many generations of loggers in the Pacific Northwest in California. In fact, my uncle was one of the people chosen to meet with President Clinton at the Timber Summit in Portland many moons ago. And I was just deer hunting with my dad and my family. It's a tradition of ours, and on a mountain that burned completely last year. And my cousin, who's a logger, was in tears as we were walking through because he just said this could have been preventable. Like, this didn't have to be this bad. There's so much dead, like, infected timber with bugs and dying timber, and the, you know, Forest Service, the way that they manage the timber up there, wouldn't do anything about it. And so it just burns. And, you know, loggers get a bad name, but they also see themselves as gardeners. And it seems like there's no in-between on that note. Everything's so polarized right now. I'm constantly caught between these two worlds where people don't want to understand each other or how to manage things in a compromise. So I'm just curious about what you have to say about that.
Shelley, appreciate hearing from you. And what do you have to say about that, Scott Stevens?
Well, it's a good point. You know, there's no doubt that you can actively manage some of our forests that used to burn frequently. They used to burn every 10, 15, 25 years. We know that from fire history records. And yes, you can do some things to actually reduce their vulnerability. And logging or mechanical systems that go into these systems and manipulate the forest can be part of it. The only thing I would just say is we have to think about the surface fuel. The surface fuel is a dead and down woody material on the ground, also the shrubs that have grown up in the last 50, 80 years. Those materials are the highest hazard of our systems today. So when we go in and manipulate a forest, and I actually think that's a good thing to do, and we do this for a restoration purpose, we can generate maybe some saw logs for local communities. But we have to think about surface fuels and ladder fuels. The ladder fuels are the trees that are more intermediate size and provide that vertical continuity. But yes, that's one thing that's important, is there really is hope in California forests. We can do things today to really reduce vulnerability to wildfire, to climate change impacts, and make systems better. Because these systems used to get disturbed every decade or two just from fire. So we can somewhat manipulate those types of ideas and do something really positively. And the governor did sign, as you mentioned earlier, SB 901, that provides $200 million a year for 5 years, as long as the new governor endorses it, Newsom, that we could begin this maybe a little more in earnest and do it more strategically. So I think in some ways we might be able to see some positivity there. There could be some things that could be really be useful.
Let me get back to Shelley's point, though. You know, probably you may agree with this, but not everyone does. You were in a pretty strong debate here on forum with environmentalist Chad Hansen of Earth Island Institute. I hope you remember that. It was on our air, and it is in our archives if people want to listen to it, that more logging equals less wildfires. Your thoughts at this point?
No, you're right. That's why I always try to stress the importance of surface fuels. The surface fuels, unfortunately, have no value. You know, they're the material on the ground that basically have accumulated for the last 100 years, but they have tremendous energy when fires burn, like even the campfire. The campfire, I'm sure, was driven by surface fuels, also crown fuel. We know from good data that California forest density in a lot of places, the Sierra Nevada, Southern California mountains, they're up maybe 2 to 3 times as many trees per acre, and we know that from really good data throughout the state. Chad may disagree a little bit, but the data is robust. So that just tells us there is ways that we can live with these systems and actually make them better to climate change. We look at the current forest conditions in this state, the vast majority are in conditions that we don't want to have when we move forward the next 10, 20, 30, 50 years with climate change coming down the pike, fire and everything else coming. We can do better. So I would acknowledge some of his concerns, but I also can take you to some places in UC Berkeley Blodgett Forest. We can go there someday, and we can show you the restoration we've done and what's happened. We have data to show that we're not harming anything. So I think it has to be part of our toolbox.
Bring another caller aboard here. That's you, David. Join us. Welcome.
Thanks, Michael. I couldn't disagree with your guest more. The global warming is drying out the mountains earlier and earlier every year. 3 years ago, was it, that everything was the snowpack was gone by the end of January? And I mean, it's inevitable that when there's no water in the mountains to slowly melt and feed the Central Valley, that everything is going to dry out up there. And the idea that getting rid of the old stumps and downed logs that have been laying there for 100 years is preposterous. The idea that all of the critters, that's where they live. That's your ecosystem up there. And what, are they just going to create new jobs chopping up old stumps? That's just ridiculous. But the one question I wanted to ask, involved with the knowledge of Teledyne owns a weapons research lab down in the Southern California, down in the L.A. fire down there. And it was said that the fire down there started in that weapons lab area. And the hazmat in that area is incredible, possibly radioactive wastes as well as all sorts of accelerants and nasty chemicals. So that smoke that's blowing through Malibu and, you know, the areas could be incredibly toxic. And the fact that it has a prevailing wind that's coming from the east, I mean, California gets winds from the ocean, not from the east. It's extremely rare to have it coming from the east. So I'd like to get an answer. Why is this incredibly stout wind coming from the east?
David, let me get a response for you from Scott Stevens.
Yeah, I'll talk to the first comment. You know, and here we can actually talk about some things that are actually on the ground today. This idea that you can't do forest restoration, that you're going to cause harm and you're going to maybe cause a calamity. You know, the Southern California mountains had a severe drought, 99 to 2002, that I mentioned. I actually testified at a U.S. House of Representatives hearing during that time. Millions of trees died, and that without any fire. Subsequent, some fires did burn in that country, and they were really difficult. I've been working in this forest in northwestern Mexico called the Sierra San Pedro de Martir. It's an area, similar forest type, similar elevation, similar soils, but it's never been harvested, and fire suppression didn't begin until 1970. It experienced the same 99 to 2002 drought as the Southern California mountains. But instead of actually having tens of millions of trees die, we measured it down there. About 1.5 trees per acre died. And then it burned in 2003 in a wildfire, some of it. So we went down there after that. So 4 years of drought, just like the ones in Southern California. Then it burns in a wildfire, 2003. We measured it. 20% of the trees died, 80% lived. The reason that system is so incredibly intact is, of course, no fire suppression, but it's large trees, low density. And when fires burn down there, they don't kill like we have in California. So it gives us hope. Every time I go to Sierra San Pedro Martir, I was down there last June, gives me great hope of what forests could do in California. So there's no doubt that we can manipulate these forest types, and we could change wildlife habitat some, but we're going to be able to keep that forest intact, and the Sierra San Pedro Martir is a great, great example of that.
And can you address David's second point about those winds and the dangers that are down there in the southern part of the state?
Absolutely. You know, those Santa Ana or east winds are part of that environment. You know, and there's no doubt they are rare, but they come almost every year because of these high-pressure, low-pressure systems that bridge the Pacific and interior part of our nation there. So these high winds out of the east or the northeast are these conditions when we have severe fire weather days, and we unfortunately then have these fires occur. But I'm afraid those parts of California like that are getting these winds every year, and it's part of their history.
He was talking about the vulnerability, I think, of that weapons station that's down there, too.
Yeah, there's no doubt that when you burn areas, I mean, when we burn vegetation, of course, it makes us gag a little bit, unfortunately, and PM10, the particulates. But when we burn homes, we burn a weapon station, we burn infrastructure, the materials that go into the atmosphere are completely different, and they're much more toxic. So all the fires that are burning in these areas, and it'd be worse in a place that had toxic materials, it's going to spread that material downwind, and it's something that concerns us.
Well, speaking of that concern, I have Lisa Fasano on the line here. Lisa Fasano is Director of Communications and Outreach with the Bay Area Air Quality Management District, and they regulate stationary sources of air pollution in the nine counties that surround San Francisco Bay. And Lisa Fasano, welcome to Forum. Good to have you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Michael.
Glad to have you. What can you tell us at this point about the air quality?
Well, air quality continues to be unhealthy throughout the Bay Area. We got a little bit of a respite yesterday because we had some slight winds, but then the wind stopped and the smoke just came right back in, and we're back where we were. So we have unhealthy air quality in all nine counties, and we have just now issued a winter spare the air alert through Friday, which means that no one can burn wood in their fireplaces or their wood stoves through Friday, because any additional smoke in the air is just going to potentially push us into an even worse category of air quality than we have right now.
Are you also advising people to stay inside?
We are. We're asking people to stay inside with their windows and doors closed. We want them to put their heating systems on recirculate if it has that option. If not, just staying indoors is the best option. And people who are going outside are experiencing a dry throat. They're recognizing that they're having difficulty, it feels like they need to have drink a lot of water. And it's because the air is so dry and there's so much particulate in the air. So we need people to stay indoors, and we need kids to basically pull out the board games and do very quiet activities, because we don't want children running around and breathing in more air.
Do you know if the stores still have masks, or can you say something about air purifiers?
Well, if you have an air purifier or a HEPA filter, you can put that into one room of your home, and if you can seal that off, you can create one clean space in your home. My understanding is, from what I've heard from people, is that the N95 masks are pretty much sold out throughout the Bay Area. I know that people are having difficulty finding them, and so that makes it challenging as well. And just putting, you know, a bandana over your face or something like that won't help. Fine particulate is tiny. It's the fraction of the size of a human hair, and so when we breathe it, it goes into our lungs. It can bypass our lungs and go into the rest of our body system. So we really want to stay out of the area where we have high PM as much as possible, and unfortunately, that's nowhere in the Bay Area.
Lisa, I've got a caller who has a question that I think you can field. Namiko, join us. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for the show. My question was pertaining the effects of the particulate matter to the soil and crops, and how that's going to have the long-term impacts of that, not just on our physical health, but also on our soil and our water. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the question. Longer impacts. Lisa Fasano.
Well, the good thing and the bad thing is, I mean, fine particulate, you can breathe it in, and it's very damaging. The other thing about it is that it's easily washed off. So after we get through this time period, if you have plants or outdoor vegetable garden or crops, they can be hosed off or washed off, and you can get them cleaned off and get rid of that particulate. The other thing about it is that these fires are burning so hot that all of the household debris and the business debris that's being churned up in this fire up in Butte County, it pretty much takes it down to levels that are just harmful because of the fine particulate. There will be some metals in there, but there'll be trace, and we shouldn't see huge problems with that settling into the soil.
I don't know if this is really something you can address, but Robert asks about the long-term effects of air quality. Let me, in fact, read what he writes here. He says, can you dig a little deeper regarding the consequences of the current Bay Area air quality? Are current effects on our health considered just a short-term annoyance, or are there long-term health consequences for various populations?
You know, I'm going to have to leave that up to the health experts. I know that they don't want people breathing fine particulate matter, or PM, because it has an immediate health impact on folks. But as far as the long-term consequences, it certainly does get into our systems, and I'm just not familiar with how the body is able to deal with that. But it certainly does pose a short-term or an immediate health impact for people. And so the more we can protect ourselves from it, the better off we all are.
And we certainly hear a lot about the perils for people who are suffering from various diseases involving their lungs or their pulmonary system, or who have HIV, those kinds of things. Always important to bear in mind. And Lisa Fasano, thank you so much for joining us. Good to have you with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Lisa Fasano is Director of Communications and Outreach for the Bay Area Air Quality Management District. And we're going to go right to another caller, and that's Ed in San Jose. Ed, you're on.
Hi. It occurred to me that when PG&E is trying to decide whether to de-energize a line, that their motivations might not be the same as the safety of the population. What about having a unaffiliated board of consultants or something that PG&E, when there's high wind danger, that they have kind of on hand to help them make decisions like that?
You mean some kind of advisory board that has no connection to PG&E or is independent? What do you think, Scott Stevens?
No, I think it sounds like an interesting idea that you could have another source of information that could be then used, that then could be acted upon. And I think it's not a bad idea.
All right. We'll find out what more of our listeners want to bring to the fore. Here we go to you next, Philip, up in Calaveras County. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I live in the Lower Sierras, and I have about 65 acres of land that's heavily forested, and I've been doing a lot of fire suppression work for about the last 20 years. One of the sadness sadness is for me is that I have so many Douglas fir, ponderosa pines, sugar pines that, you know, I can't give away. And one of the items that has been brought up to me is that because of the decline in logging in the area, that all the old lumber mills were closed. And so previous fires have made it such that there's too much capacity for the present mills that are here. And I wonder if some sort of a federal program that would reinvigorate that, and it would be a kind of a two-for win where you're not only depleting the forest, you're
Philip, I'm going to have to cut you off because we've got seconds left here. I want to get a quick response from you, Scott Stevens, on Philip's call.
I think infrastructure development in the state is important, both bioenergy and maybe you can make some chips into electricity, and also infrastructure that can deal with some of these small to medium-sized trees. I think it's part of the solution. It's actually been discussed in the state capitol.
And you can find a link with resources how to help campfire victims. Go to kqed.org/forum, and we will obviously continue to follow this and monitor this. Hope for the best and full containment, and that those missing will be found. Thank you, Scott Stevens. Good to have you with us on Forum. And thank you, our listeners. Another hour ahead. Stay tuned for that. I'm Michael Krasny.